So the tenth and final of the perfections is a quality called equanimity. The Pali or the early word is upekkha. The Sanskrit is upeksha. And this is a quality that's very, very emphasized in the Buddhist system, in all of the Buddhist systems. And it has an interesting place in that there are several different lists of qualities that one is enjoined to develop. And equanimity is almost always the last quality in the list. In the list of the stages of insight, it's the final kind of large scale kind of quality to develop. It's the final, essentially, phase of the cultivation of states of heart that are conducive to awakening. And following the stabilization of deep equanimity, there's nothing further to do to awaken other than to open. And it's also the last quality in this group of perfections of the heart, and it has a very interesting place in a series of qualities that develop as one cultivates concentration. So as the mind gets stable or steady, equanimity has a particular place in the developing of that as well. And it's in other lists as well. So it returns again and again in these teachings. So we've talked about it before. In a simple way, equanimity is a quality of responsivity to experience, where we are no longer, you could say, pulled off our center by the charge of the things we experience. By pleasant and unpleasant is really the charge that we're talking about. So equanimity as a quality experiences pleasure without attachment and experiences pain or discomfort without resistance or aversion. And in a way, it is then not only a very, very mature quality in spiritual practice, but it's also the method of practice all along. Like from the very beginning, we're told to observe things that are painful without, as best we can, reacting to them with anger or fear. And we're told to observe things that are pleasant without, as best we can, reacting to them by grasping or attachment. And then, of course, you might have noticed that this is tremendously difficult to do, nearly impossible, perhaps, for some, or at some phases. So it's a deeply mature and cultivated quality. And I'm going to talk about it in a particular way. And I'm going to use the metaphor of magnets. And I want to say that we are, in a certain way, a kind of magnet. Let's say that the metaphor is that pleasant and unpleasant experience is like charge on a, now I'm going to be, you know, someone who went to art school, not actual university, even though I just got a PhD, but it was sort of in art school. So I might get the science wrong, but charge happens on like ions, right? Something like that. And, you know, particles are charged. That's about as good as I'll get. And charge in a certain way means that an amount of energy is in them and it pulls in a certain direction. And we call charge positive, you know, plus and minus. And so let's say we're magnets, right? My baby got a set of magnet blocks recently. Mm-hmm. And which kind of look cool. You think like, oh, cool, magnet blocks. But it turns out they're kind of hard to build with because if you don't put them right side around, they slide off each other, mm-hmm. right? Because if magnets are aligned one way, they stick together, and another way they push away. So let's say that experiences that we have. And experiences basically means sense phenomena, to be technical, right? So like images, you know. I'm walking around town, I see somebody, I see all sorts of somebodies, and with each person I see, there's a little tiny push or pull. Some of the people I like, kind of instinctually, some of the people I dislike instinctually. We could say some of the people I'm drawn to, some of the people I'm afraid of. We can say some people I don't notice because they're kind of neutral to me. But in a certain way, that's also a kind of subtle charge. Like they're very subtly not the thing I'm attracted to, so I don't even notice them. I kind of ignore. And that's a very subtle sort of negativity. And so I go around the world like a magnet in a world full of other magnets, constantly affected by the charge of things that I come into contact with. And the things that are pleasant to me, the instinct is to like them, and then to want more of them, and then to do things to get more of them. Right? So the sequence is contact, pleasantness or unpleasantness, liking or disliking, grasping, right? And then doing stuff about that grasping. So I was in the auto shop the other day. There was another person in the auto shop. It was a mom with a baby. I have a baby, so now I'm all about babies. So the baby smiled at me, and I was like, hey, baby. And we went, wah, 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 wah. And then I had a conversation with the mom about, you know, how awesome 6 months old is and how awesome 13 months old is. And as I'm doing it, I'm like, oh, you're nice, and your baby's nice. So there's like, oh, I like you. And there's this little bit of charge. And I was waiting for my car to get checked out, and the mom and baby did their thing and left. And I had this little pang of, oh, it was fun talking with them. I wish they were still here, right? I mean, I could talk with the baby. Maybe I could play with the baby. And I don't know what has come over me. I've become like this. Charge, right? If they had been a different sort of person with a different sort of accoutrement, like not a baby, some other thing, I might have been like, oh, I don't want to talk to that person. I'm going to wait outside, right? And this we do this all the time. It's instinctual. It's cultural, which, of course, means this is where bias and racism and you know, sexism and attraction and desire and all that whole realm of, like, what you like and what you don't like, consciously and unconsciously, mostly unconsciously, lives. And if you let this kind of settle in you, you might get the sense that like this is everything. This is the entirety of how we spend our moments, is reacting to the pleasant and unpleasant. So equanimity, what would equanimity be? I remember when I was a kid, I learned how to make magnets by taking a piece of the right kind of metal and taking a magnet and rubbing the magnet along it in a direction a whole bunch of times. You get all the particles, ions, small magical beings in the metal to all point the same way, and then suddenly you have a magnet. How do you make a magnet? You rub everything in the same way over and over and over again, right? You rub me in the same way over and over and over again, and look, you know, I get charged in a certain way, right? I have the same kind of experience over and over and over. And look, I learned to like this kind of person and dislike this kind. I learned to like this kind of food, this kind of entertainment, this kind of place to live, this kind of weather. All by getting rubbed by charge over and over. Practicing equanimity is then tremendously difficult because in the beginning it requires us to pull against, in a way, our instincts, some of which are biological, but many of which are cultural. And that's very difficult to do, right? Because we have to actually first see that it's a charge, not just the way things are. And this takes waking up to a certain degree, right? And then we have to pull away from that. In other words, stop rubbing in the same direction. We have to rub things in the other direction every once in a while, which is uncomfortable. when I first started tuning into kind of patriarchy and feminism, and started the kind of process that would sort of open toward at some point, you know, in my 20s, my being like, oh, I'm a feminist, part of that was being taught to notice sexism and misogyny and patriarchy. And then, and this was part of the rubbing in the other direction of what I had grown up in, to recognize that, oh, I'm in the position of power in the patriarchy, being in, especially an educated, mostly white, if you don't count the Puerto Rican Bronx in there, which I do count, so partly white, but highly educated, middle class, straight passing man, cisgendered man, I get a fair amount of power. And to rub against that took education, and it was uncomfortable because it was like, oh, now I have to practice some things like not always being right. Oops, I don't like that at all. Right? So then, or I practice like not taking up space, you know, in a conversation. Here I am giving you a lecture, haha. There you go. When I teach, especially in yoga teacher training programs, and I teach philosophy largely, philosophy and history, so this stuff, for teacher training, very much in the yoga world and in the yoga teacher training world, it's not uncommon for me to be teaching a class of essentially kind of 30 women. And there's often like one or two men in the room. At some point during teaching yoga, I built up this practice where whenever it happened to be that I was the only man in the room, which was often, I had a practice of always mentioning patriarchy and being like, hey, look, I'm the only man in the room. I'm teaching. Why am I doing this? This is wrong. Any of you that really like history and philosophy, study it. Like, do it and teach this. And, you know, put me out of a job. Because if the yoga sort of scene is, you know, 98% female in this country, the teaching scene is has a very different percentage. There's still a lot more men teaching per capita than there are women. Anyway, that's a footnote about sexism and patriarchy in the yoga world. But learning that that was the case, you know, for someone in power was uncomfortable. I had to rub the magnet the other way. And part of what it does is it takes away some of the charge of the pleasant. So, like, in relation to being a man in power, the pleasure was the pleasure of power. Like, oh, it's nice. People respect me. I can say stuff. And taking away some of that was like, oh, when I'm in a, you know, when I'm collaborating on a team, I'm going to really stand back and try to make space for a more egalitarian mix. As I did that, the pleasure of power shifted and drained away. It wasn't as pleasurable because I could feel that it was part of a painful system. We are enjoined, we are encouraged to do this essentially in relation to everything on this path. So everything that we consider pleasant, the encouragement is to feel it, to feel the pleasure of it, to feel why it's pleasurable. And then to assess, in a way, whether it is what we would call wholesome or unwholesome pleasure. In other words, is this pleasure coming at the expense of someone's well-being? Is this pleasure leading eventually to some result that's not desirable? And if so, I need to feel the charge, but learn to lean away from it until the charge itself drains away. In other words, I drain away my magnetism to that thing. I learn how to not attach to the pleasurable and to not resist the painful as much. Mindfulness in the concentration path is called, or sorry, not mindfulness, equanimity is called when it's in the process of meditation, it's called the perfection of mindfulness. And this is a little bit subtle. It essentially says that when equanimity is developed, when this quality of balanced reactivity, not being too reactive, not being reactive at all in a certain way, is developed, mindfulness, that quality that recognizes what's happening moment to moment, only then is mindfulness operating kind of perfectly, as it were. And I understand that like this. Mindfulness is the quality that knows what's happening when it's happening. So I know that I'm seeing you. I know that the room is warm. I know that I'm worried a little bit about my father who has had a major medical thing happen. I know all of these things that are present in myself. When there's sadness, I know it. When there's joy, I know it. When there's confusion or numbness, I know it. That's mindfulness. The opposite of mindfulness, then, is something like distraction. Or we could say, something's happening, but I'm not recognizing it. I'm not awake to it's happening. So, like, I'm having a conversation with my sweetie, and it's going in a difficult way, but I'm not mindful that it's going in a difficult way. I'm just caught in the feeling of being resentful or defensive or whatever it is. And I'm not aware that I'm that, right? I'm just like, oh, I hate when you do that. Rather than being like, oh, look, I'm triggered and defensive, right? So to know what the feeling is mindful. If there's not mindfulness, which again is just a quality in the mind to cultivate, it's either present or not, or on a spectrum, it's strong or weak or absent. When mindfulness is weak or absent, what's happening is that there's thoughts and feelings and sensations that I'm not noticing. And in a certain way, this is happening all the time. Like, if I'm focusing on what to say next, I might be not mindful in this moment of the heat in the room. I'm kind of ignoring it. We could say that the only way I would be able to do that, since at least for me the heat in the room at the moment is slightly unpleasant, the only way that I can really just let it be and be like, it's just the room, it's like this, there's nothing to do, is if I'm not particularly troubled by it. In other words, I have equanimity around the heat. I'm not sitting here giving the talk, but some part of my mind's going, oh, damn it, it's hot. I hate that it's hot. It's always hot after yoga classes. I shouldn't teach in yoga studios after hot classes. It's so unpleasant. If I was doing that and not noticing that I was doing it, right? That's part of what we would say, oh, I'm distracted. I'm unaware. And we would say there's not mindfulness present. So here's the connection to equanimity. I will propose that any time mindfulness is not present, in other words, when we're being pulled away by something, anything, that thing has charge, pleasant or unpleasant, that we're also not aware of, and therefore equanimity is also not present. If equanimity is present, mindfulness is present. Partly because if true equanimity is present and I'm not pulled by any charge, the only thing left to do is to be aware. Or to be asleep, let's say. Like, I'm not pulled by charge when I'm fast asleep, nor am I mindful. But if I'm awake, and I'm not pulled away by anything, my awareness would naturally land on what's happening. Because there's nowhere else for it to be. Right? I'm either present, or I'm lost. And lost means caught by some charge, pulled by charge, magnetized by something. We don't think about this very often. Often we relate to thoughts, especially thoughts in meditation, say, as if they're kind of random. Like, oh, the mind just makes thoughts and it's kind of, mind wanders, it's neither here nor there, but you just notice it and come back. As if the thoughts are kind of just like, you know, a background radio station. And this is taught sometimes in my tradition. Like, don't worry about them, just notice that it's thinking and come back. I prefer myself to notice them and notice that they have charge, that almost all the thoughts that pull us away, the feelings that pull us away, are repetitive patterns that have emotional charge. They're things that are either pleasant or unpleasant. I'm trying to plan the future because I'm a little afraid that things might go south. I'm remembering the past because I have regret about something that I said. Or I'm remembering the past because I miss something that I've lost. All of these things have a charge to them. They're pleasant or unpleasant. And we get a little caught by them. Get lost in them. So then equanimity is not just a state of balance where reactivity has quieted and I'm present with whatever's happening. But it also means I'm present in a continuous way, the definition of strong mindfulness. So then concentration and mindfulness and equanimity all weave together. Equanimity is the end of all the lists and is considered to be the doorway to liberation, partly because it is essentially the state that liberation consists of. If liberation is freedom from the defilements or the, I know that's the old sort of very charged kind of Victorian word for greed, hatred, and delusion, attachment, aversion, and confusion. But I like it, defilements. If liberation is the state where the defilements are absent forever, and equanimity is the state where the defilements are absent temporarily. Equanimity is the thing to hang out in if you want to become liberated. And therefore it's the thing to practice. Essentially we're practicing liberation when we're practicing equanimity. The last thing I'll say is that one of the ways this is tremendously difficult is that there's one more quality. There's lots of qualities embedded in this. The one I'll emphasize is renunciation. Because to do this, we actually have to do a pretty radical maneuver in relation to our culture and the way we've been raised, which is that we have to actually be willing to not pursue pleasure, sensual pleasures. And we have to be willing to not be running away from pain. And this doesn't mean I put myself, you know, like if I'm standing in the crosswalk and the light changes and there's a truck coming, I'm like, oh, I'm equanimous, so I'm not going to move. Mm-hmm. That's not equanimity. That's just, like, dumb, and it doesn't last very long. This isn't about, like, kind of the sort of nervous system instinct of self-protection, right? That's what this grows out of. In a certain way, the defilements just grow out of the natural quality of self-protection. If you come at me with a knife, it's appropriate for me to be like, whoa. Have you had your coffee yet? But equanimity is more like, you know, I'm responding to things that are not immediately life-threatening with the sense that they are. This opens up the whole conversation about trauma, which we've talked about in here before. We'll get into again, but not tonight. But it's radical to approach our situation in a way where we're willing to take things as they come with a much gentler response. And it's renunciation because it means the whole world of like consuming and shopping and buying stuff and getting pretty things kind of drains away. It means consuming friendships and relationships and like getting them and holding them and maintaining them. The attachment drains away. The friendships are wholesome. And in a certain way, the paradox that we always talk about, and we might in the question time, if it comes up for you, we can tell me and we'll say more about it, is that, you know, for instance, friendship and love are considered to be wholesome and encouraged on the path. At the same time, there's a recognition that the kinds of grasping and attachment that we do in relationship can be so painful. What else about this? It It's a bit of a renunciation because we turn away from the task of constantly gratifying our senses with pleasures, and we're willing to, in a sense, experience a simpler or less, we're willing to not just like tickle our senses all the time and think that that's a good life. And we're willing to take what comes in the unpleasantness department without thinking that it's wrong or evil. So I'm having some substantial unpleasantness in my family right now. My dad had a stroke last week. And he's all right. He's talking, and he's grumpy, so we know he's himself still. But, you know, in talking with my other family members and just in myself, right, there's the temptation to go, this should not be happening, right? Which is not equanimity. I don't know that I have equanimity around this thing, which is so intense, but I'm awake enough to how it works that I don't want to say, this is wrong, this should not be happening. It's actually part of the natural order of things. It's a conditioned experience. It's based on who we are now and our all of the conditions of having a body and, in his case, being 74 and, you know, having the life he's had. No blame. And so how different is it, rather than saying, this should not be happening, this is wrong, to say, oh, look, now this is happening. This is what's happening. Right? This is part of being human and real, and I'm part of his family. I'm grumpy too. Maybe that's how we know we're family. And one of my teachers says, our job then in the world where there's so much pain is simply to be an island of coherence. An island of coherence. This is equanimity. Like, everyone around is going to be kind of freaking out, perhaps. And our job as practitioners is to say, oh, this is what's happening now, and it is not wrong that it's happening. It's not wrong that our country is about to inaugurate a very difficult administration. It's painful to me and indicative of deep disease in our system. But it's not against the law of nature. Right? It's actually unfortunately an appropriate conditioned response to how things have been for many decades here. In a certain way, it makes sense, right? And the fact that my dad had a stroke, in a certain way, if one could put together all the conditions of place and lifestyle and culture and ordinary humanity and the way brains work and all the whatever, it makes sense. So then the challenge with equanimity is to understand that and live within it and know it and to know that people die and that it changes. And that keeps happening, and it makes sense, and it's lawful, and we don't need to be attached. And yet, we care, we love, we take care of each other. It's also wrong to turn away in a kind of indifference. Right? And this needs to be said. All of the good qualities in the Buddhist system come with what's called a near enemy. And the near enemy is a quality of the heart that looks like it, but is not it, and is unwholesome. And the near enemy of equanimity is indifference, not caring. And this is now a puzzle for us, because we're so into our attachments. What is it to care deeply but not be reactive? What does it mean to love profoundly and be intimate with, but not be confused or crave or be off our center about? And that's in many ways the practice, right? Because we hear renunciation and freedom and letting go, and especially as a young man, I was like, I can do that. I'm already profoundly unattached to anything, you know? And it took 20 years of practice to be like, oh, oops. that's called male oppression. And, you know, all the things that it is, that's called being a depressed suburban teenager. That's not equanimity. It's like, oh, I'm profoundly detached because I'm miserable. It's like, oops. Right? Actually, equanimity is soft at heart and really quite loving. And when I've touched it, I've been like, oh, that's what that is. It's not indifference or separation or removal at all. So that's a puzzle and really, in a sense, a fine line to walk in our practice as we cultivate this quality. Take a moment and just rest together, letting the words settle. And seeing what bubbles up on its own. Listening with kindness, with equanimity, perhaps, or not. It's fine either way. In the last part of our time together, I'm going to hear some other voices, hear your own reflections on this topic or anything in your practice that you'd like to bring forward, questions, reflections.
Okay. Sean, thank you so much again. I have a situation now, and I was thinking, you know, like, hopefully I'll come in tonight and I'll hear what I need to hear, and I think it happened. Actually, I'm finding myself polarized in it with a negative charge, right? And I'm getting just carried away with that.
Totally.
And I was wondering if you have any, like, specific techniques or suggestions on how to get depolarized. To at least like a natural condition, because I find sometimes it's kind of hard to stop. It's like my super mind understands that, you know, like it's not a good thing to do. It's like I need to be unattached to that, but I still feel vindictive and find myself like passive aggressive. And I see it, but I don't want to stop the behavior. Because I want to show them all.
Or something.
I mean, like, you know, like I'm already planning on things I'm going to be doing.
Yeah.
And, like...
As we do, of course.
And I'm telling my boyfriend because we have, like, a good relationship where I can talk about it. And he's just laughing at me. And I cannot stop. I'm like, I'm going to do this, and that's my plan. And
Well, you know, humor is a start, right? These are very deep patterns that, and we've talked about before, that in a certain way the whole Buddhist model in relation to grasping and aversion and charge is essentially an addiction model. You know, it's really talking about why do we do things that we know are painful over and over, and we can't stop even when we tell ourselves to, you know. How many gazillions of times have I been doing a certain thing, you know, like whatever it is, you know, eating a certain food or scrolling through Facebook or going, you know, hanging out with people that aren't really my people or whatever it is, you know, and be like, why am I doing this? I know better. And then just like next week, here I am again doing that thing. And so part of it is really recognizing, seeing, this is the observation part, the mindfulness part. Really seeing the charge for what it is. Be like, oh, look, this has a grasp on me, or I'm grasping this in a way. It's unconscious. There's not blame in this, but be like, oh, this is a powerful thing. And then a couple things are suggested. One is to slow down with it and actually feel for the the emotion or the feeling underneath the action. Like, oh, I keep planning or I keep doing this thing, it's anxious or it's whatever. If I slow down, drop into the feeling, I'm going to find the feeling that is contracted or painful. Oh, I'm afraid. Whatever. I'm angry. I'm confused. So both of those are sort of basic practice. You have to notice it, and you have to actually kind of dig into it a little bit, investigate it a little bit, and feel what's painful in there. If we really feel that something is painful, we're less likely to keep going doing it. And then there's other things that are kind of maybe obvious or simple, you know, which is like, just remove the stimulus, you know? If I can't stop eating any number of things covered in chocolate sold at Trader Joe's, because they have so many things covered in chocolate, it's their specialty, I could just be like, okay, we're not buying those, right? If they're not in the house, I'm less likely to eat them. So, you know, if I... I just finished my dissertation. Those of you that don't know this, it is true. Partly I got through it using an app called Self-Control, which is ironic, of course. You would only have the app if you don't have said quality. What it does is that you put a list of websites on it that distract you, and then as soon as you click the app on for a certain amount of time, you can't pull those up. Even if you restart your computer, and even if you uninstall the app, you can't break it. So you put Facebook, and in my case, it was the New York Times and the Guardian and the New Yorker, and the news obsession that I do. And and the most interesting part about it was I wouldn't want to turn it on. I'd be like, it's fine, I'll be focused. And I'd be like, turn it on, you know. And once you turn it on, once I would turn it on, a whole part of myself would relax. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, just, you know, it's like lock the door, throw the key away, you know, or at least put a timer on it, and go about your business. So like just taking the stimulus away is a thing. So we play with it in lots of ways, but the heart of it is to notice the pattern and to feel the pain or to feel the emotion that's underneath it, whatever it is. It's usually anger, fear, or confusion. Yeah?
Right, it just lasts long.
What's that?
I don't want it to last that long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not wanting it to last long is also attachment, right? Because that's an active pushing away. Unfortunately, you have to hang out with it in order to work on it. You have to actually be like, okay, here it is. And you sort of sit down in your spot or you pause and you're just like, oh, I want it so bad. And you have to be willing to just like hang out there and be like, oh, it hurts, I want it so bad. And just stay there until it changes.
Oh, yeah. One quick question. Yeah. In your practice, when you go through emotions or attachments like that, do you find that chanting or other techniques, like spiritual techniques, help to like change that vibration or condition?
All sorts of techniques help. But if they... Techniques fall into two categories for this kind of thing. Some of them pull your attention away from the thing into something else, and some of them bring your attention toward the thing. So like if I'm trying to get into it in touch with, if I'm trying to process anger, chanting might make me happy, which would change my state away from the anger, but it doesn't process the anger. Because it just is, it's a kind of distraction. It could be a wholesome distraction, but it's still distraction. The only way I process anger is by being with anger. So then, in a certain way, mindfulness is king, queen.
Thank you.
Yeah. That doesn't mean that other things aren't useful. They're tremendously useful. Especially when I don't have the strength of heart to stay with something, I might need something else. Maybe I stay with anger for 30 seconds and then I just can't stay with it anymore. And then I do some chanting, or I go for a walk, or I, you know, jump in the lake or something. And then I come back to it and resume. And the early texts say exactly this. They say, Vipassana is so hard, you'll be sweating and clenching your teeth, and you'll be just like struggling so hard against the defilements. And so you need to take a break sometimes. and relax your mind, and then come back to it. Other thoughts or reflections here?
For me, I'm very reactive, and I would have a lot of things I would do that would get me into trouble. Like, I was a school administrator in Oakland Unified, and I'd write emails when I'm angry, not a good thing to do, you know. And so there's something in more of the Indian Sanskrit path called shreyas and prayers. Shreyas is something that if you do it, it feels really good, like just screaming at somebody when you're angry, but then afterwards you feel badly. And prayers is something you do where you take a step back and you don't react. And then when you have had more time to have compassion with yourself, you react. And what happened to me is that I did it enough, so I realized, oh, I'm going to have to live in this. And if I react, it's so uncomfortable. So it's almost like a selfish thing. Now I might act more together because I don't want to live in that. So that helped me a lot, and I actually saw it shift a lot. Not to say I'm not still very, you know, in my stuff. The other thing that helped me was this story about this monk. This disciple comes to him and he says, I don't know what to do with all these sorrows, this election. It's just so overwhelming. I don't know how to hold it. And they were on the banks of the ocean, and he said, get a cup of water. So the disciple goes and gets a cup of water, and he says, put a spoonful of salt in. And he does, and the master says, now taste it. And he says, how does it taste? And he said, salty. And then he said, okay, take a spoonful and put it in the ocean, a river, whatever was I said. And then he says, okay, put the cup in and dip it. And he said, how's it taste? And it doesn't taste salty. And then he says, like that, you have to make your container bigger. So for me, sometimes chanting and stuff helps me make my container bigger to hold my stuff. Because yeah. I can't make it make sense, like with my mother's cigarette. I mean, that doesn't work for me. I like have to be vulnerable and say, okay, this feels really sad. It's my mother. I have to hold that and recognize and witness that and see that. But when I say it, if I put it into a box, and it's like kind of just I'm smart and I'll reverse cycle psychology with myself, so I can't do that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah. All of this is great. It's good to hear from you. Like, these are all tools to support this spacious quality of heart that we're talking about, you know, how to not get hooked by something, you know, and it takes a lot of support, we would say, to be able to do that, for sure. Yeah.
So, what about with things that are like so deeply? I remember when you were talking right after the election about kind of holding acceptance and resistance.
Yeah.
And, things that are just so deeply traumatic, like, that you have to say, like, the part of your process almost in the fact that they're traumatic is, like, calling them out as unnatural or brought about by, like,
sure.
karmatic conditions that make them feel really unacceptable. Like, how do you deal with something that kind of, you know, breaks into that dichotomy of acceptance and resistance?
Mm-hmm. It's hard. I think we do it in different ways with our different personalities, you know. But one of the ways is in a way like this, you know, like the salt story, this ancient metaphor, is to make the container bigger so that the disruption isn't as cataclysmic as we think. You know, so one of the ways that I do that is through history, you know. And I could be like, the incoming presidency seems like a disaster, But you know, it's probably not as bad as Andrew Jackson in 18, you know, da-da-da. Or I could be like, you know, every empire swings from, like, liberal to conservative, from, you know, permissive to authoritarian. That's the nature of systems. Here we go, right? Like, if you make it big enough, you could, you know, you can be like, well, you know, the Roman Empire made a whole bunch of great art and some really incredible literature and probably a lot of happy people for a while. And then they overstretched themselves in a globalization push, lost the taxation base, and fell. And then look, something else happened. You know, who are we to think that our thing should stay pleasurable? Then you flip it and you go, is it even pleasurable? Yeah. Oh, our thing is tremendously painful for most of the people in it. So is it traumatic? I don't know. 23% of the people think it's going to be fabulous, you know, or whatever number. So so one thing is a bigger picture. I've talked about this before. I don't talk about it a lot, but I'm more and more don't want to shy away from it. In the Buddhist system, that big picture is partly gained by having a vision of the universe as being infinitely long and repetitive. So this isn't your one lifetime. This is one in a gazillion lifetimes where you've been every kind of person, animal, ghost, God realm being, everything. And in the scope of that, you can say, oh, you know, this trauma right now is a tiny thing compared to the whole thing. The thing that I'm cultivating over those millions and gazillions of lifetimes are the qualities of the heart. So it's more important, in a sense, for me, and then by extension my community and my culture, as best I can influence them, to be kind and consistent in our virtues than to freak out by the given thing that is just happening. A better way to say this, in the current lingo, is when they go low, we go high. Right? Mama Michelle's brilliance. There's a way that part of what is so annoying to a bunch of lefties right now is that the Obama administration isn't resisting the incoming apocalypse as strongly as they could. It's actually been annoying for decades that they don't resist the incoming apocalypse as vigorous as they should, you know. And then you can step back and you can say, as some commentators have said, you know, why are they doing this? They're actually preserving the integrity of the system over winning this particular battle. They're going high. And then a whole bunch of us are like, don't do that. Fight dirty and win this one. It's that important. It might be. Or is it? And that's a question that I'm not going to preach like, oh, we should do this or that in relation to this. And I want us to stay active in resistance. But from a place, at least for me as a practitioner, that my practice, my ethics in practice, absolutely must be foremost. Right? Because if the thing I'm cultivating is liberation, and it takes millions of lifetimes, it's a far deeper setback for me to abandon my ethical commitments than it is for me to lose a battle. Now, the social justice warrior in me wants to always say that to do that is in part a privileged position because I'm not fighting for my life. And so then I want to use that privilege and the ability to broadcast a certain clarity of ethic, if I have it, if I can, as a way to stay in engagement for those whose lives are being threatened. And again, that's part of the paradox of equanimity, right? It's hard, you know? Like, there's so many things happen that... It's a little bit like, you know, if the spectrum of shit that goes down has at one end, like, the very real life-threat traumas that are real, where self-defense is appropriate, where boundaries are appropriate, where sometimes, you know, a kind of very strong response is appropriate, all the way to sort of the subtleties of, like, profoundly subtle grasping onto existential things. If that's the spectrum, it's a fluid spectrum. It's not like there's a line at which we say, you know, on this side of the line, it's a real trauma to be responded to with action, and on this side of the line, it's a spiritual subtlety to be responded to by subtle transmutation. That line shifts all the time, right? And sometimes it's appropriate to really step back and observe, and other times it's appropriate to engage. And actually, that just changes all the time. So I respect profoundly the question, right, that you're asking, because it's part of how we have to figure out how to be here. Yeah? Yeah. Anything else? Or anyone want to throw in on the tails of that? Yeah, Stephanie.
So I just want to mention one thing that actually you led us in a sit, must have been like about a year ago at this point, that actually I practiced myself in my daily practice for months after you led it, and I think it very much touches on this question of equanimity, and also, as you just mentioned, this kind of deeply engaging and then stepping back and observing. And I feel like this is a good practice to cultivate in order to do that in life. You had us like sit and we had, you know, first observe the breath and then just get deeply in touch with what was happening in us, in our body, in our emotions. And then you had us kind of step back and take the seat of an observer and noticing it from that perspective, and just the part of us that is observing, the part of us that's deeply engaged. And then at one point you said, and notice that both of those are always happening. And there's, you can kind of go in and out of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was huge for me. And I even noticed myself, like, still, even though I don't do it as like my daily practice anymore, in intense moments, there'll be a part of me that's just like out here, that's like seeing all of it happening. And I'm just like, wow, that's interesting. But inside I'm just like, I'm pissed. And, you know,
yeah.
And So I just wanted to bring that up because it was something that you had taught, and that it just was like, just to me, really touches on this practice of equanimity. And like you said,
yeah,
in order to have true equanimity, it can be mistaken for indifference, but the real thing is being deeply in touch with what we're actually feeling.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I'm glad for the reminder of that. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it's tempting to be like, oh, I'll just take that position out there and stay there, you know, in a kind of disembodied observer. It's like, no, that's not, I tried that, it doesn't work. It's actually like, oh, there's no distance, actually, right? Like, equanimity sits right here and is like, oh, I'm observing the profound pain of my broken heart right now, and I'm not going anywhere. Because to go anywhere is to push away. So it's like, oh, this, like, oh, you know, and sometimes I'm just like, oh, this practice, it's so annoying. It's like, it's relentless. It never gives you a break,
yeah,
from your commitment to be real, you know, and it's like, oh, you know, but then, you know, a moment later, I'm like, oh, thank God, right? Because as you were saying, the alternative is worse. Like, it's painful, but the alternative is worse.
Mm-hmm.
Spacing out on yourself, acting in ways that cause harm, is worse, right? It hurts more in the end. So then you just really like, Trungpa's, I'll end with this, Chogyam Trungpa, amazing Tibetan teacher, he said at the end of a beginning meditation course, he said, you all came in here, you didn't know what you were getting, just a funny old Tibetan guy. But now that you've heard the teachings, I'm sorry to tell you, you're doomed. Like, it's all over. You can't unhear the reality of what awareness is, you know. end. So practice has that quality to it, which can be both sort of like eye-rolling, but also then a profound refuge. You know, it actually becomes a thing that holds us, that big container that holds us, no matter who gets elected. Mm-hmm. So, if you missed Obama's speech, and if you like him, it's worth going back to listen to. KQED's replaying it at 11, so you can go home and listen to a final hour and a half of rational, kind, intelligent presidential talk. Yeah. And then if you're really a junkie, you can go and watch those like highlight reels of him and Michelle playing with dogs and children and all of that. So thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to chat about this. We'll see where we go next in the series of kind of expanding on the collection of basic teachings. And I'll go back and build in some of the ones that we lost the talks for, and we'll just keep going. Happy New Year, whatever that means. Thursday's the last full moon of monkey year, Yang fire monkey year. So the big, crazy, craziest tricks, thank God. Yeah. Get out of here, you old monkey. So 2 weeks and 2 days left, and then we get a new year within this tradition, at least. Whatever your relationship to roosters, they're less insane than monkeys. this class, as always, is offered fully in the tradition of gift economy. Your generosity with your resources is both a practice of letting go and a support for the ongoing, for the maintenance of teachings like this offered freely in the world. So thank you for your generosity. Everything you leave is split in half between the studio and myself and goes in the basket up there by the little fake candle.
Oh, it's split in half?
It is split in half. That's our scene. So be generous and know that, that's why I say it. So many blessings. See you soon. Yeah.